You are listening to the Middle East Institute's podcast series. To support MEI's programs and podcasts, please donate at www.mei.edu. Thank you for your support.
My name is Daniel Serwer. I'm a scholar at the Middle East Institute and a professor here at Johns Hopkins SAIS. And it's my great pleasure to moderate today's event on confronting the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, challenges and options. For those of us who have spent a lot of time and effort trying to understand what's going on in Iraq and Syria, trying to, over really quite a lengthy period now, trying to figure out how things can go right, it's pretty appalling that things are going, I think, very badly wrong, but I will expect the panel to enlighten us on that. It's an extraordinary panel that brings to the table a lot of very direct experience with Syria, with Iraq, with extremism, with terrorism, with the American administration, how it might respond. I'm not going to read the bios, but I'll recommend them highly to you. I have known three out of the four speakers for quite some time, and I'm always amazed at the talents, the accomplishments that I read about in these bios that I didn't know about previously.
That's because we make them up.
Well, I don't think so. I think they're very real. We'll start with Rhonda Sleem, who is now, like me, I think, associated with both the Middle East Institute and with Johns Hopkins SAIS. She has, I first got to know Rhonda working in and on Iraq and on sectarian relations in Iraq, about which she knows a great deal directly from the people involved. Omar al-Nidawi, I've been reading a great deal of. He's at Griffin Partners, Griffin Partners, for those who don't know, I associate with the name Zalhalizad. He is a very sharp analyst of the region. Steve Simon, who is now at the Middle East Institute, but who has spent recent time in the White House on Middle East issues, and Richard Clark, who's the chairman of the board of the Middle East Institute, both bring to the table enormous knowledge of how the U.S. administration reacts, what instruments it has at its disposal. So we're going to start inside Iraq and work ourselves inside out. There will be the hint of a sectarian overtone in the way this panel is organized. I wish it weren't so, but I really do think that's imposed on us by Iraq rather than something that was invented in Washington. Rhonda, if you'll start at least in part on the Shia side of the equation, then Omar will do the, at least in part, focus on the Sunni side of the equation, and then we'll turn to the Washington angle. Rhonda.
Thank you, Dan, and thank you, MEI, for your invite. It's really an honor and pleasure to be with me, to be here with my fellow panelists, and I look forward to hearing their perspectives on what's going on in Iraq. As Dan said, my take on Iraq is informed by years of toiling with Dan in the field of national reconciliation in Iraq, having worked there between 2006 and 2009, and really we ended up with without much success. And then also it's based, and I've been asked to talk about the Shia perspective, but also I'm going to bring into the discussion some of my observations from a recent trip to Tehran, which happened to take place 2 days after the IS takeover of Mosul, and that gave me an opportunity to hear up close some of the perspectives inside the Iranian political spectrum about Iraq and necessarily about Syria. So the first question is, how popular is Maliki? You know, when we talk about Maliki, and Maliki must step down, and I think the guidepost I will rely on is the parliamentary elections held in April. In those elections, Maliki outperformed all his rivals by a significant margin. His state of law coalition garnered 24% of the vote, 92 seats out of 328 of the parliament. Maliki himself secured 720,000 votes. His closest rival won a third of that amount. In addition to that, there was a Gallup poll done June 6-9, just 2 days before the IS takeover throughout Iraq. And one of the questions asked during this poll is the following. Do you approve or disapprove of the way Nouri al-Maliki is handling his job as prime minister? In Kurdistan, as expected, 12% approved. And I thought that was high, 12%. In Sunni majority provinces, including Anbar, Kirkuk, Diyala, Nineveh, and Salahuddin, 30% said approved. Again, I felt that was high. In Baghdad, which is a mix of Sunni, Shia, and Kurds, again, the approval was 54%. And in Shia majority areas in mid-Euphrates, like Najaf, Babel, Qadisiyah, Karbala, as well as the south, in Basra, Diqar, Mais, and Muthanna, the percentage of those who answered this positively or approved of the way Maliki was handling his job as a prime minister was 77%. Granted, that was before Maliki and the army under his guidance lost one-third of Iraqi territories to IS. But still, so whether these numbers still hold true is questionable. However, it might be counterintuitive to some of us here that, in fact, his stock might have risen within at least his main constituency, the Shiite community. If you look, for example, at how the popularity of Assad has risen in Syria among the Alawite, how the standing of Hezbollah has risen among Lebanon Shia, because of the fact that Alawite, Shia in Iraq feel they are facing an existential threat in Islamic State, and they feel that Maliki, with his hand, steady hand, can be somehow a means to protect them and to defend them. So anecdotal evidence based on talking recently with Iraqi lawmakers as well as with people in Iraq who I consider to have a pulse on the Shiite community tells a tale of a community that is gripped by two fears. There is a fear of the Islamic State, but also there is a fear of a return to sectarian civil war. The remilitarization of the Shia, as well as the reactivation of these former militias, Shiite militia, is causing many in the community to fear that a return to sectarian violence is now inevitable. So what are the prospects for Maliki to stay in his job? And what is the debate to date inside the National Alliance about Maliki's candidacy? I mean, his state of law alliance, as well as Maliki, are still sticking to the idea that Maliki, based on the general election results, is their candidate. He is rightfully entitled to form the cabinet as somebody who has, you know, who has the largest bloc in the parliament and who has secured the highest number of votes in the last elections. There is now a debate ongoing inside the National Alliance, which is a grouping of Shiite political parties, centering around two scenarios. I think the debate has moved beyond Maliki staying or not. I think the intervention by Ayatollah Sistani, which is, for the first time, it was a clear and public intervention against a Maliki third party bid, has really dealt his candidacy, I'm not going to say a deadly blow, but a very heavy blow. And so there is now a debate of two scenarios. One scenario is to have a consensus candidate, Shiite candidate, emerge from within this alliance, while giving Maliki and his alliance the priority to handpick him. And Tariq Najm is one such name, former chief of staff to Maliki, that has been proposed. To date, as of 2 days ago, another name that's being proposed by Maliki is the current governor of Basra, Majid al-Nisrawi. Now, the fear is that this will send a signal to the Sunni community that this is going to be more of the same. It's going to be a different figure there at the top of the government, but basically Maliki will continue to pull the levers of power behind that figure. And so that will prevent them from, you know, in looking at this as a beginning of a new phase. Scenario two, which calls for a split inside the Shiite camp and for the Sadrist along with Hakim's Iski to split from Maliki and to form alliance with the Sunnis in parliament and with the Kurds, and to pick a strong independent candidate who has strong credentials, who can send this signal to the Sunni community that this is truly the beginning of a new phase as far as the prime minister is concerned, as far as the prime minister office is concerned. The two names that are being floated within that scenario are Adel Abdel Mahdi, the former vice president of Iraq, as well as former minister of finance and defense in Iraq, Ali Alawi. Now, the problem with Ali Alawi is that he is not too much favored by the Iranians. They look at him as I was talking to Omar, Shia-lite. And so Adel Abdel Mahdi might be more of a favorite choice as far as the Iranians are concerned. However, the only way for this second scenario to unfold is for the Sadrist and Iski to ally to do that. The Sadrist are pushing for it, are ready to do it. However, they don't want to go solo. They need Iski and Hakim to go with them. And so far, Hakim has been reluctant to endorse this split inside the Shiite political alliance. And that is a signal that Iran maybe is not happy about that. Now, what does Iran think about all of this? How much time do I have?
A couple more minutes. We're very interested.
Okay. Don't worry about us.
What does Iran think about all of this? As I said, 3 days after IS now take over of Mosul, I was in Tehran on a pre-scheduled trip to learn more about the drivers of Iran-Syria policy. And lo and behold, Mosul happened, and instead of discussing Syria, most of my conversation ended up pivoting around Iraq and Mosul and what was going there. Now, the picture I get, granted, I'm not an Iran expert. There is a Mr. Alex Vadenka here who is a much better Iran expert than I. I'm just relaying what I heard in series of conversation with Iranian officials and analysts that really govern the political spectrum from reformers to hardliners in Tehran. For Iranian officials, the development in Iraq were seen at the time, and I still do, as part and parcel of their fight against a regional Sunni extremist coalition that primarily aims to contain Iran's ideological and geopolitical status in the region. So for Iranian, for Iranian official, ISIS offensive in Iraq and the ISIS takeover of Raqqa is part and the same of this conspiracy to destabilize its two regional neighbors and allies, Iraq and Syria. The argument that was made by one official who is closely involved with Iraq policy, Iran-Iraq policy, is that the massive mobilization and organization of ISIS, which they have seen in Mosul, and they, by the way, they admitted that they were shocked in the first 48 hours of the advance, that they were taken back by the speed, professionalism, and capacity shown by the ISIS in their advance toward Mosul. That this mobilization, the planning, the financing, that was beyond the insurgents' capacity to accomplish that without assistance from regional and trans-regional states that have logistically supported and financed ISIS in the past. Now, if you look at what Maliki said after the takeover, before that, what Said Nasrallah in Lebanon said about what was happening in Syria, what Bashar al-Assad said about what's happening in Syria, they all talk the same line. There is the Sunni conspiracy that includes the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks, the Jordanians, and, of course, the Americans, and that all is aimed at destabilizing Syria and eventually and Iraq, leading, in fact, to bringing it to the point or the brink of disintegration, thus undermining Iranian interest in the Levant. Now, in terms of priorities, the first priority was for the Iranians is to fight this terrorist group is to fight terrorists, group like ISIS in Mosul, but also group like Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria. At the time, while I was there, there was an interesting debate going on inside Iran about whether this was a moment of collusion of interest between the Americans and the Iranians, sharing the same interest of fighting against ISIS, especially after Rouhani's press conference at the time, in which he hinted about the possibility of that. In order to understand the lines of that debate and how it settled, I recommend a piece that Kayhan Barzakar has written for the Belfer Center, in which he goes in detail about the lines in that debate and the different voices and how it eventually settled on the idea that this is not the time for collaboration between the Americans and the Iranian. Now, in terms of solution, when you push the Iranians about solutions in Iraq, they always say that, like in Syria, the solution is political, not military, and that the solution in Iraq should lie in balancing the demands of the different Iraqi political forces, Shiites, Sunni Kurds, in the context of a coalitional government and a united Iraq. Now, at the time, in terms of when I probed about what is the future of Maliki and whether Maliki should stay in power, I sense and I heard a different perspective than vis-à-vis Assad. Whereas on the issue of Assad, there was almost unanimous agreement among all my interlocutors, reformers, hardliners in the middle, that there is no alternative to Assad in Syria, at least for the foreseeable future. On the issue in Iraq, there was, in fact, one senior official who is supposed to be closer to the IRGC surprised me when he said, well, we are not wedded to personalities to Iraq. I mean, there are certain principles that need to be followed in the selection of the next PM, and that Maliki, given his electoral performance, should be given the priority over others. But if, you know, the different parties in Iraq see to it that somebody else should be at the helm in the prime minister office, you know, let it be. So since then, I heard from Iraqi lawmakers that Iran has become, I mean, a little bit hardliner on this issue. And the argument that Iran and Maliki is making is that this is not the time to really do too much change, that this is a time when you need steady, experienced leadership. This is a time that by forcing Maliki to step down, that's the argument that I heard even some Iranians say, but also Maliki is keep pushing it, is that by forcing him to step down, you are handing IS and their regional sponsor a victory. Because as Maliki's resignation has always been one of their demands. I think, as far as the Iranian calculus, I think there has been a game changer with Sistani's position. Sistani has the moral gravitas, not only and the political gravitas, not only in Iraq, but also in Iran, in the rest of the Shiite world. And so him coming out and his office coming out so clearly and strongly against a Maliki third-part bid, I think is going to make it hard for Maliki to stay in power. Again, the question is, will we move towards scenario one, where Maliki handpicks his successor, or whether we move toward scenario two, where we have a truly independent person in the position of PM. I'm going to finish with one last point. I would argue that the risk of losing Maliki, and I can talk in the question of answer about how they look at Assad, but the risk of losing Maliki for Iran are much less than those of losing Assad. And partly because in Iraq, Iran can count on a deep layer of first and second rung Shiite leaders they trust and rely on. This is not the case in Syria. For example, Iran can live with pretty much any nominee, any Shiite nominee for the PM job by Dawa or Iski for the job. I don't think Iran has or enjoy the same depth in Syria among the Alawite or even among Syrian regime officials. I will stop at this point. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rhonda. Omar, if you can take us even deeper into Iraq.
Thank you, Dan.
And maybe Syria as well.
Sure. Longer. Thanks to NAI and SAIS.
Omar, before you start, let me just urge those who are standing in the back or those who are in the next room, there are seats available if you want them. And I urge you to, there's one up here, there's some down there. I urge you to make yourselves comfortable. It makes me uncomfortable to see you standing. Omar.
Yeah. So I think most people observing Iraq agree that a political component is necessary for any resolution of the security crisis and restoring stability to the country. One problem that, or an issue that arises immediately, as Randa mentioned, is that a political compromise that addresses the grievances of the Sunni population or the Kurds would be like rewarding bad behavior, and that's a problematic issue. The other issue is that for a political component to succeed requires not only actions by the government, but also a positive response by the Sunni community, the other side, that is key to this crisis. And the problem at this time is that the Sunnis are deeply fragmented. Generally speaking, there are perhaps four different views that characterize the Sunni views towards the situation in the country. There is, of course, ISIS or IS and their immediate supporters who want to establish and expand a 7th century caliphate in Iraq and beyond. There is another group, insurgents like the Naqshbandi army or ex-Ba'athist, who see the ISIS advance as an opportunity to go and all the way to Baghdad, overthrow the government, and restore Iraq back to pre-April 2003 situation, where it's a quasi-secular, Sunni-dominated state. Another group is less hardline than that, but they see government atrocities in the past, like the deadly raids on protest sites, which result in the deaths of dozens, and the consistent marginalization of the Sunni community. They see that the only response is to use military means to carve out a region that guarantees autonomy similar to the Kurdistan region. And, of course, there is the fourth view, which looks at the previous three options and sees that they are not feasible and that the only practical way is to continue to work within the political process and try to figure out a solution that is acceptable to the community. Of course, if we're looking at ISIS, or the insurgents, or those who are in favor of the Sunni region and continuing the military option, I think they are perhaps being too hopeful in their ability to counter ISIS after Baghdad if Baghdad falls. Looking at the current trends in security situation, the clashes, daily clashes between ISIS and other insurgents, and the situation in Syria, it looks like this way of thinking is problematic. So why are the Sunnis divided? I think there are some fundamental issues that cause the Sunni political class and Sunni community to be divided. If you want to talk or negotiate with the Shia political class, you go to Baghdad, or if not, you go to Najaf or Tehran. You have a more or less unified religious authority, and you have one major regional backer. That's not the case with the Sunni Arabs, who have no such unified religious authority, and their regional support comes from states across the region, all the way from the UAE to even as far away as Libya. And these states have different, sometimes even competing interests. The divisions even gotten much deeper over the last 4 years since the results of the 2010 elections, when a lot of Sunni political class in the community saw that they had put in all their effort and hopes into the Iraqi bloc that won the most seats in parliament, but they saw that Maliki had outmaneuvered and kind of hijacked the elections at the time and formed a government despite his being, having fewer seats at the time. And that gave a sense of frustration that even if you win, you can't really achieve your goals. That was compounded, of course, by Maliki's consistent and relentless effort to break the ranks of Sunni political parties, chasing away those he saw as a threat, those with enough ambition to challenge him, and co-opting those who were less ambitious and less threatening. Things culminated, of course, with the April 2014 elections, where Maliki's surprisingly strong show in the elections and his winning technically the largest number of seats this time kind of sealed the deal that Maliki is perhaps going to stay and that he's not going out and not stepping down. And what this means is that this has weakened the argument of those who advocate a political solution and gave more traction to those who call for violent measures to change the situation and address Sunni grievances. So I think dealing with this fixing this state of fragmentation and hostility is both necessary and quite difficult. But I think it's critical to use to reduce this fragmentation by coordinating the positions of regional powers that have leverage with Sunni parties or with Sunni insurgents, and that also includes Iran, of course, and try to. Perhaps I think U.S. leadership would be the most valuable asset here is to try and convince these powers that they should agree on a least common denominator, and that is defeating the ISIS threat and trying to protect Iraq's territorial integrity. These are things very low, you know, we're setting the bar too low. I think that's something that those powers could agree on, especially if they see that what happened in Mosul could happen again elsewhere in the region. There are also, I think, measures of reconciliation that are needed immediately to change the perception of marginalization and injustice. The needed reforms for a long-term solution are complex, and they're time-consuming. They might be out of reach right now. Things like creating more autonomy, fair revenue sharing, depoliticizing the military, complete reversal of de-Ba'athification. These are issues that take time, but there are perhaps some quick measures that can the process of isolating ISIS and to restore a little bit of Sunni faith in the political process. And I think on top of that, of course, is expediting government formation with a cabinet that is led by someone other than Maliki. Again, changing faces perhaps is not very important, but it's perception, and perception matters a lot. We saw today that the parliament finally elected a president. This is a step in the right direction. Second point, I think, is related to that as well, is to reintegrate some selected high-profile Sunni politicians. The court a few weeks ago dropped charges against a few Sunni MPs. One of them now is its new Speaker of Parliament. This was, specifically important gesture. But this could be repeated again with other figures whose overthrow in the beginning the charges against whom in the beginning kind of precipitated the crisis, like, for example, former finance minister Rafe Isawi. Maybe Tariq al-Hashimi is beyond redemption at this point. I think a third point would be, I think it's quite obvious that to build on the lessons learned from 2007, 2008, where Sunni tribes became an important asset in fighting Al-Qaeda in Iraq at the time, could be useful in fighting ISIS now, too. I think no force can take back Mosul unless it is supported by the locals or is formed of the locals. And there are many thousands of Sunni men of fighting age who are in Kurdistan or in parts of Anbar that are not controlled by ISIS who have lost faith in the government, but they also don't like ISIS, and they could be persuaded, and again, U.S. leadership, I think, and pressure is important, to form new fighting elements that could open new fronts against ISIS and continue the pressure on it to at least contain the situation and prepare for a more robust plan. I think none of these are magical solutions that promise an immediate resolution of the situation, but what you need is some immediate measures that show, that prepare the ground for diffusing the tension, and perhaps buy Iraq the time, by Iraq and its allies the time that it needs to forge a more lasting solution for real reform. I'll close with that.
Thank you, Omar. Steve, yesterday Brett McGurk told the Congress that IS is no longer a terrorist group, but a full-blown army. Brian Jenkins the other day wrote that we're in the midst of an all-out sectarian civil war. So I guess the question is, how much should the United States care about this? What specifically should we care about? And what instruments do we have to respond if we want to respond?
Thanks. Brett? I'm going to take the first 20 minutes or so to talk a little bit about the history of the conflict, which I think is important to contextualize. And then I'll take the next hour to talk about all the things the U.S. can do to restabilize Iraq, get a grip on the situation, and jumpstart democracy in the Middle East. You'll have killed me by then, so I'm not really worried about the time. In thinking about the U.S. role here, I was looking back at the, you know, what the U.S. was doing several years ago in Iraq when the U.S. still had a very large force presence there. As some of you may recall, there was a big debate in the mid, the 2006 time frame, basically, over how the U.S. should deal with the burgeoning violence that was sweeping Iraqi society at that time. And there were two basic views that were advanced. And we all know, once you hear me rehearse the two, you'll know which one won. But I'll go through it anyway. First, you had General David Petraeus, who was in the U.S. at the time, and he was busily scribbling away on the U.S. manual for fighting an insurgency. And in a lot of ways, he and his team did quite a brilliant job, because looking through many examples going back to before World War I, they came up with a list essentially of best practices of how one should fight an insurgency with some hope of success. Now, among those requirements were securing the population, ensuring that the government in power distributed services and goods equitably across society, and that the outside power was not only doing this on behalf of a government striving for some measure of legitimacy, but also had some staying power. And General Petraeus went to Iraq to put these practices, put this theory into action, let me put it that way. There was another way of looking at it, and that was from the point of view of the loser in this debate, who was General Petraeus' predecessor as the commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, General George Casey. He wasn't a skeptic about counterinsurgency per se. He just thought that the conditions that David Petraeus had stipulated as essential for a successful counterinsurgency didn't obtain in Iraq. And he thought so for a couple of reasons, the main one of which, I think, was that the Maliki government, which was in power at the time in Iraq, was actually not a central government in search of legitimacy, needing outside help to battle an insurgency, but rather was just another sectarian faction in a civil war. And if, to the extent that that was true, then the underpinning of a successful counterinsurgency campaign simply didn't exist, and it wasn't going to work. Now, in retrospect, listening to the discussion here, certainly, it does seem as though General Casey's perception of Iraqi politics at that time was somewhat shrewder than General Petraeus's. I think he was the one of the two who really hit the nail on the head, and we're seeing this play out now. Now, that's all background, essentially, to what the U.S. can do, because the U.S. can't muster even the sorts of things it had at its disposal while the debate, the Petraeus-Casey debate, was going on in the mid, early 2000s, in the 2006 to 2007 time frame. At that point, we did have the troops, especially after the surge, which was another five divisions plus, I guess, a Marine regiment, or brigade, rather. We did have the troops in country to do the kinds of things that General Petraeus endorsed, and for a time they did work. But even then, we didn't have the kind of political influence within Iraq that we needed and would need now to generate a new dispensation, a real different turn or direction in Iraqi state policy. So that means that we're not going to be doing very much, or we can't really. We'll be acting on the margins. Now, when you say, well, what can we do? I think one has to ask, what can we do about what? In other words, what do we think needs something done about it? I think, you know, from the foregoing, you can see my own impression is that on the bigger issue, there isn't really very much. On lesser issues, you know, we can act. So, for example, if we define this issue as a CT problem, and you're flagging Brett McGurk's characterization of the issue right now would suggest that at least he thinks it goes well beyond that. We're capable of decapitating cells, making it very difficult for these guys to act, certainly act outside of Iraq and Syria, which is, from a CT perspective, our principal worry. And what the Europeans are finding out right now is essentially that the backflow is not a problem. There wasn't a backflow the first time around, although we all anticipated it, and I and others wrote a lot about it in anticipation of it, but it just really never happened. And it doesn't seem to be happening thus far. The Europeans and the Americans, for that matter, because there have been a couple of Canadians who've gone to Iraq, think that they're like the Lincoln Brigade, you know, in the Spanish Civil War. They think that they're doing something really cool and great, and they're nothing to be ashamed of. They don't view it as terrorism. They view it as, you know, defense of values and nothing to hide, which is to say that U.S. and European intelligence and law enforcement authorities are in their knickers. There is nothing unknown about these people, and they'll be quite hampered if, in fact, they come back with the intention of doing harm. Now, what the Europeans have found out, additionally, is that when they do come back, they come back so traumatized that all they want is their normal life back, because it's a very ugly place there. Now, I just want to wrap up with a remark about, you know, Brett McGurk's characterization of ISIL as an army and all of that. The Iraqis have an army too. That is the Iraqi regime or government, whatever you want to call the sectarian cabal that Maliki presides over in Baghdad. And a lot of it isn't worth very much. And there was a Pentagon report that many of you've seen that's now been publicized, it's been in the newspapers, where the judgment is about a third of the army is functioning well enough, or at least potentially so, for the U.S. to have a role in helping it perform better on the battlefield. Well, a third of a 900,000-man army is a big army. By Middle Eastern standards. So, you know, they've got people. That's number one. And the second point is, if you look at Syria, the way in which the army performed there, it's really quite interesting because on analogy to what has happened in Iraq, you know, you had this initial explosion of, you know, of rebellion in Syria, and right off the bat, the Syrian army seemed to fold. You had large-scale desertions, not unit-level desertions, and no serious defections, but you had a lot of desertions. The army shrank quite considerably, And it really looked as though, as they lost territory on the scale with which the Iraqi army lost territory in the initial phases of this civil war, that, you know, they were going to collapse. And that many people thought that in the 2011 timeframe. But they got their act together. And they got their act together for a lot of reasons, but those are the reasons why the Iraqi army, the rump Iraqi army, will probably get its act together too. And it will do so in part the same way that the Syrian army did with respect to the integration of paramilitary forces, militias, where in Syria, one of the things that the army did quite effectively, perhaps with Iranian help, was to integrate the Shabiha units into the regular forces and coordinate their operations in ways that created altogether a much more combat effective force. There's really room and precedent, in fact, for the Iraqis to do the same thing. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve. Dick, if I understood Steve correctly, he's suggesting that our interests lie mainly in the counterterrorism area. And that in addition to using our own means in some limited ways, we need to rely on the remnants of the Iraqi army. Is that sufficient?
Well, having me and Steve on a panel together is usually redundant. But I will find a way to disagree with him. It may take some effort. I think if now we're obviously here, an audience and a panel very interested in Middle Eastern affairs. But if you step back and project yourself into Kansas or someplace in the heart of the United States, anybody here from Kansas? Didn't think so. I think when the American government and the American Congress and the American people look at Syria and Iraq today, if they're able in their minds to distinguish it from Gaza, which many of them are not, for those who are more informed, they really do have to think what fundamentally is the American interest there. And that is enlightened by what went on in the first decade of this century. It wasn't that long ago, but some of us seem to have forgotten that we spent over $1 trillion, probably closer to $2 trillion in Iraq. We lost 5,000 American soldiers, Marines. We had 50,000 or more American soldiers and Marines badly injured and who are still suffering and will suffer for the rest of their lives without legs and with PTSD and with traumatic brain injury. And for all of that cost in blood and guts, we didn't get very much, if anything, for it. We were not able to affect what went on in Iraq despite essentially unlimited spending. No budget, no limit on what we were willing to do. We did everything we could, maybe not too wisely, but we spent a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of people, and were unable to affect what went on in Iraq for more than a couple of years. That has to be the framework in which we look at the situation from an American perspective in both Syria and Iraq. We have to be very realistic and modest in our assumptions about our ability to affect anything. Now, the good news is I think the administration realizes that. I think we have people in the White House and elsewhere in the government and in the Congress who are now a lot more realistic about the ability of the United States to affect things. What is fundamentally our interest? Yeah, sure, the first order interest is always the immediate threat to the United States, and that, another word for that is counterterrorism. we have a situation now in both Syria and Iraq where something that looks a lot like Al-Qaeda, it's not, and they have their little internecine disputes between Daesh and Al-Qaeda, but it looks a lot like Al-Qaeda. And from an American perspective, it might as well be, is running cities. There's a front page story in the New York Times today. We were talking before the panel about Raqqa and certainly Mosul. There are governments in these places that are administrating territory. It's hard to believe that if that were to be sustained, that that wouldn't pose the possibility, at least, of being a terrorist sanctuary the way Afghanistan was in the 1990s. Here's where I'm going to disagree with Steve, who said that there doesn't appear to be a threat of backflow, which means Europeans who have gone or Americans who have gone over to fight who then come back and pose a threat to their countries. I don't think we know that yet. I'd agree that it hasn't happened yet. It hasn't happened yet in part because French and American and British and even German now and Canadian authorities are arresting people before they go there. But the estimates that we have are that there may be only a handful of Americans, maybe only 100 involved in that two-country sanctuary, but as many as 7,000 Europeans. And Norway today, unlikely place, but Norway today is in lockdown because they have received reliable intelligence from a third party, I hope it's not us, that suggests an attack from fundamentalist Islamic cells is imminent in Oslo. Who knows if that's true or not. But I think fundamentally we do have an interest, not just in terms of counterterrorism, but in terms of regional stability, in not wanting there to be a Daesh, IS, ISIL, you choose your name, sanctuary, functioning government in the Syrian-Iraq border area. What if the Syrian army ultimately can't clear it out? What if the Iraqi army, which is largely a Shia army, can't clear it out? Maybe they can. Maybe it'll just take time. But in the course of doing that, of course, the Iranian influence in the region is going to strengthen because the Syrian army could not have done it without Iran, what they've done so far, they could not have done without Iran. Iranian fighters, Iranian equipment, Iranian intelligence. And certainly what the Iraqi army will try to do, it won't be able to do without Iran. So is there a way that the United States can get rid of this Daesh sanctuary, which threatens us possibly, but certainly threatens regional stability, without strengthening the hand of Iran? We're tempted, I think, like the Israelis during the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s, to say, oh, my two enemies are fighting each other, why don't I step back and watch? That is tempting, but I think ultimately it's not a great idea because of the resulting Iranian influence, because ultimately Iran and its allies will win. So what are the alternatives? They're not great, and they may not even exist, but I think the United States probably, again, realizing our modest capabilities, needs to explore whether or not we can affect alternatives. And one way is to try, and I defer to you as to whether this is possible, to try to peel off Sunni elements within Iraq from Daesh. If that's possible with Saudi, even Qatari, participation, and if it's possible to do that, and even get them to play in Baghdad, that's worth trying. People are trying. It's not been very successful so far. Another way is to think seriously about giving Kurdistan a more independent status. We have, as a country, always opposed that, in part because our NATO ally, Turkey, would always go crazy when we talked about it. What I'm hearing and seeing now out of Turkey is that they're thinking seriously about it. Turkey has now allowed 4 large tankers to be filled with oil from Kurdistan. Oil has been piped across Turkey and comes out of the Iskenderun, and in one case was sold to Israel. Interesting. We're also hearing mumblings in Ankara that they could perhaps rethink whether or not they were interested in dealing with an independent Kurdistan. An independent Kurdistan is worth thinking about. I'm not advocating it, but it's certainly worth thinking about. What would its effect be on the regional balance of power if we and others invested in it in a serious way? And the third way we have of trying to get rid of a Daesh sanctuary without strengthening Iran's hand is to have a serious program of aiding Syrian rebels. And as much as I like this administration, I have to say that their performance on aiding the Syrian rebels is either flat-ass pathetic or is an intentional policy of not aiding them. Under the guise of pretending to aid them. So just to recap, recognizing our limited capability, recognizing our limited interest, I think we as a country should look to trying to end this Daesh sanctuary in ways that don't strengthen Iran. If that's not possible, then we're going to have to live with strengthening Iran to get rid of it.
Thank you very much. Well, not surprisingly, we don't have a lot of easy answers here, but let's turn to the audience for further questions, please. I think we have a microphone someplace, no? Oh, I see we have. I thought we had one to pass around. If you don't mind going there, I think we're recording, so we need you to talk into the microphone.
Mr. Hargreaves, the Stability Institute. I just want to pick up on one thing that Richard Clark said at the end there about the role of the Kurds. One thing I haven't heard from any panelists is, does anyone think that there's a possibility that that arms could be transferred to the Peshmerga to deal with ISIS and then possibly a bargain with them is you clear out ISIS and we'll support an independent Kurdish state, per se.
Okay, let me take another question. Well, if nobody's ready yet, let me... please. No, but we need it for the recording.
Oh, there is a...
Yeah.
Thanks, yeah, Pierce Marshner. I wonder if I could just ask also to Mr. Clark... if you could talk about why strengthening the Syrian opposition, what would it get us, and how it would sort of work in those in that way in which we wouldn't have to strengthen Iran in order to see ISIL cleared out, and then if we do have to accept the fact that we're going to strengthen Iran, what are we going to do differently than those three things that you enunciated there? Thanks.
Dick, I think most of those questions are for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope I'll have some help in answering them. The first question about arming the Peshmerga, from what I can tell, the Peshmerga are pretty well armed. I don't know where they get them, but they don't seem to have any. I don't think they're in need of arms. I don't think there's a bargain to be had in Baghdad that says, you clear out the Daesh people and you can be independent. I don't think there's any interest in Baghdad in them being independent. And if were they to be independent, it would be over the strong objections of Baghdad and Tehran, by the way. Mm-hmm. which may be a reason for doing it. But I don't think that that bargain is on. I think it's worth thinking about whether or not the United States should, at some point, if everything else doesn't work, do some sort of overt relationship with the Kurds. Worth thinking about. In terms of our arming the Syrian rebels, maybe it's not possible to do it effectively. Maybe it's better not to try. But we have this sort of half-assed position right now that we say we're doing it and we're not. And in the course of executing that policy, we are, I think, undermining the confidence in the United States, in our allies, or friends like Saudi Arabia and most of the Gulf states. I happen to think it is possible, but it's quite clear that the administration doesn't think it's a big priority.
Steve, did you want to comment at all?
You, on which point?
On any of these points that involve, I'm thinking of the ones that involve American action of one sort or another.
I don't know. From my perspective, Kurdish independence is a non sequitur. The Kurds will serve as an anvil to the Iraqi hammer eventually anyway, regardless of whether they're, you know, technically independent. On the issue of arming, you know, the opposition, I mean, you'd have to find people to arm. And, you know, I think at least within government, as I recall, you know, dimly, there wasn't much of an option or clearly identifiable options in that domain. And people I talk to nowadays still don't think that there are very good options. I mean, what social science, you know, says about, you know, arming rebels, particularly along the lines that advocates, you know, seem to be describing, is that those inflows tend to fractionate oppositions even further because you set up a competition for resources that induces splits and deepens splits that already exist. So if you want to have a cohesive opposition form on the moderate side that you can then arm, arming them prematurely will essentially remove the indispensable condition for a successful arming. It's kind of a, maybe it's a bit of a catch-22. The other thing I think, and I can't speak for the administration on this, but I'd have thought that if the U.S. got into the arming business, you know, big time, assuming that those arms would be turned against ISIL, which is, I think, a very audacious assumption under the circumstances, the U.S. would, in effect, be taking ownership of what's happening in Syria. And for the very reasons I think that Dick, you know, wisely pointed out at the outset of his remarks, namely that we've spent $2 trillion in Iraq at a minimum. I mean, what Harvard estimates is that there's been between $4 and $6 trillion that's either been spent or unavoidably obligated in the future because of our involvement. I think for all those reasons, we're not really in a position to take ownership, but that would be, I think, strongly expected of the United States if we got in to create an opposition army along lines that, you know, somehow we thought would work. So kind of a non-starter, I would think, from my perspective.
Rhonda wants the floor, and I'm going to ask both her and Omar if they could comment on the reverberations within Iraq and the region of KRG independence.
I mean, on the issue of arming the rebels, I think we might not have eventually people to arm. I mean, the regime is heading toward a potential victory in Aleppo. I mean, if that were to transpire, and we're not talking about a large window here, Once that transpires, I can see many of these rebels who can be armed by us now starting to shift and join the camp of, the group that has the resources and the money. So I think this issue of arming or not arming might be moot in a few months from now, and this is a window of opportunity where action is needed. Otherwise, we are going to reach a different phase of the conflict in Syria where it's really going to be hard for us to find allies to arm.
On the KRG and the reaction in the region and within Iraq, Rhonda?
Okay. It's interesting how the KRG independence is looked at. There are press reports out there about the message that Mr. Nashirvan Barzani, when he was called to Tehran in mid-June, right after the IS takeover, was given by Mr. Shamkhani of the negative consequences to KRG if it were to proceed with a bid for independence. And I think the Iranians are pretty serious about that now. They look any attempt at destabilizing Iraq, and they would look at the KRG independence as a destabilizing factor, I think will be met by a strong and reactions to, from Iran and propensity to create trouble inside the KRG. It's interesting that the way the debate in some circles in Arab, especially what we call the resistance access circles, look at KRG independence. The theoretical thread that underlies this debate is this Ben-Gurion periphery theory or periphery doctrine, which I don't know how many of you are familiar with that, but that was a foreign policy doctrine that was proposed by Prime Minister Ben-Gurion, that for at the time for Israel to be able to stand against the united resistance of Arab Sunni countries, that it behooves Israel to strike alliances with non-Arab Muslim states like Turkey, Imperial Ethiopia, pre-revolutionary Iran, but also with non-Arab groups like Kurds, like Maronites in Lebanon. And if you look at the literature of Hezbollah, that is prominent in how they look about the civil war. And they look at the civil war and the alliance at the time that was struck between the Israelis and the Maronite of Lebanon as part and parcel of this Ben-Gurion, policy doctrine of starting to carve away a Maronite canton inside an Arab country. And it's the same now thinking that's starting to appear in some of the Arab debates about KRG independence, that when Israel failed, when Israel failed in Lebanon in the civil war, is now trying to repeat in Iraq with the KRG independence. And the fact that Israel is pushing hard for KRG independence, the fact that Israel is the one that bought the first tanker of oil from the KRG, is really, being used to substantiate and as evidence that this is what it is about. So this is how the KRG, Arab resistance circle, KRG independence, is looked at, and in some research circles inside Tehran.
Omar.
Yeah, first one point on the arming the Peshmerga to fight ISIS. I believe, the Peshmerga would probably be very happy getting new toys that they can use to beef up their defenses, but I don't think they're interested in the business of going out beyond Kurdish-populated territory to fight ISIS outside the regions where they have the local support. Also, they don't want to be entangled in what they see as a civil war. So I think they would love the weapons, but I wouldn't think they would proactively go out of their region to hunt down ISIS. On independence, it's obvious that the KRG is working constantly to lay the foundations for sovereignty and independence, but I don't think I don't think independence is imminent, and one big reason is money. 4 shipments of oil have sailed out of Jihan. Only one has been bought. Only one has paid off. And that's not enough. $93 million yes. a month is yes. not enough to sustain the KRG economy. The KRG has already borrowed $3 billion mm-hmm. for internally and externally. So where's the money? The money comes from Basra oil fields. If there is, in like the next few months to 6 months, there is an agreement on a new government and there is an agreement on revenue sharing and an agreement on increased autonomy, that gives the KRG the right to export oil, which is something that they are going to insist on. When that becomes a legally possible for the KRG, then you can start watching the clock for Kurdish independence. But at that point, it would probably not matter much because it has been already agreed as part of the grand bargain. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be too alarmed about it happening now or happening in a way that is against regional wills. If the regional will is towards endorsing an agreement that allows the KRG that much freedom, then perhaps independence would be okay.
Thank you. Other questions? I need you to get the mic around. Let's do this one, and then I'll go over there.
Hi. I'm Jennifer with the Middle East Institute. So ISIS has said that they want to establish a 7th century caliphate in the Levant. Have they expressed any interest in expanding their war beyond that, in attacking American interests, in fighting a larger war the way Al-Qaeda did? Thank you.
Who wants? Well, let me take another one. Yeah.
Thanks. Tom Lippman. I want to go back to this question of Maliki's standing as the prime minister of Iraq. It seems to me that there are quite a few things that Saudi Arabia could do in terms of, let's say, mobilizing the anti-ISIS tribes in Iraq, with which they have some very close ties, aiding the rebels. They've made clear that they're not going to do that as long as Maliki runs the Iraqi government, because the king loathes Maliki. So which is easier, getting rid of Maliki or changing King Abdullah's mind?
You put the question very, very well. Tom, yeah. Can you pass the pass that microphone back to the third person there, and then we'll go to the panel.
Thank you. I'm Chris Phillips from Chatham House. Just a brief point about sort of the panelists have talked a lot about the security threat from ISIS, but they haven't talked that much about the ideological threat from ISIS. And it strikes me that what you have at the moment is a situation whereby the longer that ISIS just exists, as long as sort of its Islamic State, its caliphate exists, it can pose a long-term threat because it is drawing in disaffected Sunnis from across the region. And in particular, what concerns me as a Syria specialist is the 2.5 to 4 million Syrian refugees. Now, as we saw with the Taliban in refugee camps in Pakistan, and actually in terms of security threat, Palestinian refugees in terms of Black September launching security threats across Europe to draw attention to their cause. Surely the longer that ISIS continues to thrive, the more it's going to pose this wider ideological threat to the whole region and possibly beyond. And I'd quite like the panelists to comment on that. Second point, just picking up on the lady's point over there, if ISIS does expand, is there a red line this time for the United States where it will take action, you know, moving into Jordan, moving into Saudi? but a serious point, is there a red line at which the U.S. will do something?
A lot of that's for you again, Dick.
When I said that our concerns with having a Daesh sanctuary and were, number one, the terrorist sanctuary, and number two, regional stability. I think that phrase, regional stability, encompasses the notion that if there is a successful state with that ideology, that will undermine other states in the region, because that ideology will be seen to be in the ascent, at least within Sunni circles. So on that question, I agree with you.
Has Daesh threatened the United States?
Oh. I think they're too busy threatening
Shiites.
Threatening Shiites for now. Ultimately, they'd get around to that, yes. I think. No? Yes.
Randa?
Yeah, on the question of Maliki, from all that is transpiring inside Baghdad these days, it looks like it's more likely than not that Maliki will be replaced. The issue is who's going to replace him and what kind of signal that will send to the Sunni community. I think a strong, independent candidate that's seen as a result of a grand coalition between the Sunnis, the Shias, and the Kurds will send a very strong signal to the Sunnis in the ISIS-controlled area, but also in non-controlled area, that this is a new phase, that there is perhaps a national project that this guy can usher in and around which the Sunni can start rallying away from the sectarian agenda and the sectarian project which Maliki has been trumpeting. However, if we are going to go to a, you know, Maliki handpicked successor, you know, as it looks like is more likely than that first scenario, then I think the signal that's going to be read inside the Sunni community is that this is more of the same, and Daesh is here to stay. I mean, let's remember, Daesh has been in Iraq now since January, and they have been in Fallujah now.
So your bet is we're going to end up with Maliki and drag, is what you're saying.
I mean, so it's going to be a weaker figure, most likely, with Maliki pulling the levers of power. I mean, he has already established quite an apparatus, presence inside all the organs of the Iraqi government, and it's going to be hard to really dislodge him and from that if we have that scenario. And I think this is also the scenario that the Iranians are pushing for. On the issue of Syria, I fully agree with you. I think Syrian refugees, as a person who also focuses on Lebanon and is from Lebanon, Syrian refugees in Lebanon, which are now, 1.3, 1.4 million, is really a serious, serious problem. And as more time passes and as they start giving up hope of returning home, until now, they have not given up hope on returning home. So they have not yet started embedding themselves in the local community, but also in the local politics. I have been predicting for some time the making within that community of a guns for hire phenomenon, like what happened with the Palestinians in 1970. As the Lebanese start, again fighting it out in the future, especially the Sunni community will need guns, will need men to fight. And the Syrian, and by the way, the great majority of Syrian refugees in Syria are Sunni, and they are not Alawite and they are not Shiite. There's some Shiites which were brought by Hezbollah into the southern regions, but most of them are Sunnis. And eventually they are going to become, guns for hire, people that can be hired. They need salary, they need money. So far the redeeming factor is 75 to 80% of these refugees have been women and children under the age of 12. But as desperation sets in, as more destruction of the infrastructure in their villages take place and they start looking for ways to survive, I think men will start pouring into Lebanon again, and we have the potential making of a serious problem going forward.
Well, Myra, what about getting some help from King Abdullah?
Well, I think to tie two issues, does ISIS want to expand? Does Daesh want to expand? I think when they dropped the second S from ISIS, or they dropped the ish from Daesh, that's a signal that not only publicity stunt or recruitment stunt, but it's also a message, a declared policy, that they do not recognize national borders, which I think should be a source of concern for the governments around Iraq. And I think Saudi Arabia is particularly vulnerable because that ideology usually flourishes very well in the birthplace of Islam, in Saudi Arabia. And as a, King Abdullah and or any of the governments of the Gulf are not seen as, more acceptable to those who endorse Daesh ideology than Maliki or Erdogan or Bashar Assad. So I think the gravity of the threat, coupled with replacing Prime Minister Maliki, would probably tempt King Abdullah and other players in the region to reconsider their positions and try to pull the strings where they can among the Sunni political parties and insurgents to contain this volatile mix that's went out of control.
Can I follow up on that?
Please.
To what extent is there a base there that the Saudis, if they decide to play, to what extent is there a base there that they can actually do anything?
To what extent they can?
I mean, we're all assuming that if the Saudis and the Emiratis and everybody got together and supported a Sunni counter movement in Iraq, that would work. I don't know that we know enough to say that that's a possibility.
Well, I think throughout history, I think most insurgencies require foreign support to continue.
But is there a base there that the foreign support could work with?
Is there a base for the foreign support for the counter ISIS? Well, it could work with Turkey if Turkey starts reversing.
I'm saying, are there Sunnis?
Well, you have people in Ramadi who are fighting ISIS.
Who
you
are
have
standing
some.
Up.
You
some.
Have, you have villages up. In the north that have been decimated.
So you think there's enough
ISIS? I think there are.
Yeah. And already we are hearing of this, you know, of, I'll say, the fragility of this coalition between the Naqshbandis, the former Ba'athists, and ISIS. I mean, now that, for example, in Mosul, Islamic State is asking, forcing women to, genital mutilation. It's calling on all women in Mosul and the area. It's correct? It's not? Well, you know, that's the story that's coming out. So if that's the case, but there are more and more stories of discordance going on between ISIS and its allies in Mosul and others. And
seems to me very hard to picture that alliance sticking together.
Exactly.
Can we have two more questions? I'll take these two right here.
Ken Meyer, Court, World Docs. It's widely held that the extremist groups in Syria and Iraq are supported financially by entities in the Persian Gulf. Does the fact that we have not imposed sanctions on states or oligarchs in the Gulf for supporting extremist groups suggest that we don't really see them as that much of a threat or even are not that opposed to them?
And I had another one right behind here.
Hi, Lars Hansen. In listening to this, and it kind of brings to mind something that I've thought now for quite a while in following this, we've talked about the KRG. That would be, Kurdistan would be a separate region that does not yet have any boundaries. We talk about Iraq. We talk about Syria. We talk about any of the regions of the country. Three of those were formed, Jordan, Syria, and Iraq, of course, were formed to reward the Hashemite Sharifs from Medina as a response for their help during World War I, and it was part of the great game by Britain and France. And I'm beginning to wonder if maybe we shouldn't be looking at the region not in terms of existing boundaries, but in terms of peoples, where they are, and what their interests are, because it seems to be have much more of an impact on things now than some arbitrary straight lines drawn in the desert. Guarantee you, if you go to the desert, you can't see that line. If I go to the River Drina in Bosnia, I can tell I'm on one side and somebody else is on the other. Thank you.
Thank you. Who wants to take on these questions? You, Steve, for the radicals, the Gulf support for extremists.
Look, I don't. Without having, access to privileged information, I'm skeptical that the states in the Persian Gulf are transferring funds to ISIL. Dick might know better, so I'm going to defer to him on that. There is money that flows from private individuals, however. And this money is collected by trusted intermediaries working with envoys from ISIL. What ISIL is perceived to be doing is a noble thing in the view of some, certainly some wealthy individuals. So there's money that flows in that way. It's become most problematic in countries that have the weakest laws to prohibit those kinds of monetary transfers. And Kuwait is a prime example where very large amounts of money are going from Kuwait, particularly to Syria, but now to Iraq as well. And this has become a domestic political issue in Kuwait, which, as you know, has a fairly significant Shia population, and they see that the Kuwaiti government's perceived turning of a blind eye to these transfers as Kuwaiti government collusion in an issue that runs counter to the interests of its Shiite citizens. So, it is a problem, but to the extent to which it's a government issue is another story, and that's what really gets to your question about, well, why hasn't the United States sanctioned these governments in some way? I don't think that there's really reason to at this point.
I think my information is pretty much the same. There was a vast outflow of private money from Kuwait, and obviously there was some from Qatar, not so much noticeable from any other country. But of course, now that's also the moot because of the assets that the Daesh have taken hold of by taking the cities that they've conquered. Mm. They've got more money than they know what to do with.
Mm. Rhonda and Omar, I think of you for the question of redrawing the borders in the Middle East.
Well, generally, I don't think redrawing the borders would make a huge difference because the competing interests are not going to change. The underlying causes are not going to change. Saudi Arabia and Iran do not share borders, but their rivalry has driven a lot of conflict. So replacing some arbitrary line with another arbitrary line, I don't think that would solve the issue at hand.
Rhonda? On this or any other issue?
Oh, my. I mean, redrawing the borders will come at a cost of too many lives. I mean, it's going to be a bloody redrawing of the borders, I don't think. And so far, despite all that has been said about the end and the death of the psychic ecosystem, you know, it has proven so far to be, you know, resistant and resilient. And maybe the only place where this is going to happen is the KRG in the future, but I don't think this is going to happen in the short term. And if we look back at Lebanon, you know, 15 years of civil war and lots of talk at the time about cantons and cantonization and division, and yet the country held together. Granted, there was a Syrian army that, you know, equalized the power between all the parties and prevented any of them from taking such action. But I think at this point in time, we are going to live with this border for some time. And I agree with Omar, it's not going to solve much.
But on the other hand, would you agree that the while we're going to live with these borders, the borders don't mean very much anymore?
No. With Daesh, no. I mean, now we have an Islamic State that spans two countries. Yes.
They actually didn't mean much when Sykes-Picot made their agreement. Sykes and Picot were not concerned with the internal boundaries. They were concerned with the seacoasts and divvying up the ports. I think the time has come for us to thank the panel for a really deep discussion.